Welcome, everyone. A very good evening. Our topic, Hilchos Internet, the power of email as it relates to Lashon Hara, Rechilos, and Shalom Bayis. It shouldn't be hard to do in one session, because as I consulted one of the poskim of our generation, I asked him, what are the halachas of Lashon Hara on email? And he said, well, it would seem that they're the exact same halachas as Lashon Hara anytime, so what's the problem? That's a cute answer, but I believe it goes a little bit deeper. It is true that the Chafetz Chaim taught us that the tongue is 100 times, so to speak, more powerful than the other limbs of a person. You could do a certain amount of damage with any limb, but if you really want to do damage, you do it with the mouth. Very powerful. The expression, the pen is mightier than the sword, is essentially the same concept. Lashon Hara doesn't have to be spoken. You can malign somebody in the written word. Same concept. The power of intellect brought against a person, intentionally or unintentionally. And as much as the Chafetz Chaim taught us the power of the tongue, email is 100 times worse. With a single click, send, the information is disseminated quite effectively. When I started sending out Parsha emails a few years ago, so I used to click that send button on Thursday mornings. And I must tell you the trepidation that I experienced as I hit that send button. It means that 1,000 people within a minute are going to have what you wrote. I hope they like it. And that's when it's Torah. A novel interpretation, an insight about the parsha. What happens when we go ahead and share the thoughts that are on our minds and we hit send? So what a lot of people aren't aware of is that the listservs, like the Yahoo groups, there are a lot of people there in cyberspace. And you can't see them all. On our Vidibarta, I believe there are 399 subscribers. I don't know if we should do a membership drive to try to get a 400th. We don't have 399 members in the shul. There's no one who can claim that they know everybody on that list. It's going to a lot of people. Potomac listserv, I believe, is 1,600. Kent Mill is divided between different listservs. So any one listserv doesn't have more than, I think, 1,200. 1,200 is respectable. That means that when I click whatever it is, my opinion, my request, it's going out to a lot more people than just my buddies. I dare say one can suggest that we should still have our own little friendship circle who we send questions to if we don't need everybody to know that our oven is broken. Or worse, someone posts that they're looking for a child psychologist. That's a violation of privacy. Unless, of course, you preface it posting for someone else. Which may or may not work. I would suggest that there emerge in a community people, preferably in the medical field, who discreetly accept the requests privately of people researching things, and they indeed post it on behalf of other people. And they will be posting things multiple times during a week, and they will indeed be representing other people and keep a degree of discretion there. No one has to know who's actually posting and who's dealing with what. Reb Chaim Sanzer, the Divrei Chaim, posed the following question to three Jews. He asked them, if you were to find a treasure chest filled with silver and you knew to whom it belonged, would you return it? The first Jew answered, of course, Rabbi, I would return it. It's not mine. To which the Divrei Chaim said, you're a fool. We need to know why. The next Jew that he asked the question to said, return it? Money! It's mine! Divrei Chaim said, you're wicked. The third Jew he posed the question to said, Reva, a full chest filled with silver? And they don't know that I have it? Listen, I hope I'd return it. I hope I would. But, you know, I can't say for sure. The Divrei Chaim said that's a wise and clever answer. Because it appreciates the challenge. A person says, of course I'd return it. You're a fool. You don't understand humanity. You don't understand what a chest full of silver can do to a person. And likewise, I say about the internet, if you're not nervous about what you post, you don't understand the fallibility of human judgment. What could happen to you when you're posting at 11:45 at night? And I'm not just talking about typos, because depending on your internet browser, they might catch the typos. What you think is a legitimate response to someone else's posting, you know, the expression, sleep on it. Tell me how you feel in the morning. And I definitely would like to try to share some techniques, some ideas, some framework. Because when Hashem gave the Torah, Hashem knew about the internet. That generation might not have known, but Hashem knew. And the halachas are the same about things we're allowed to do, things we're not allowed to do, just that we need to open the box so to speak, to extrapolate the halachas and apply them appropriately. The internet, to a great extent, is an area that we're still greenhorns. We're all immigrants. You don't have a lot of experience here. 10, 20, 30 years is not called experience. And therefore, there are areas that we're going to talk attitudes rather than case law. But nevertheless, I believe that there's a lot that we can accomplish even as the field is emerging. One comment. When people talk about internet nowadays, it's been like this last 10, 20 years, in a religious sense, they often, almost always, are talking about filters. Our assumption here is that people have filters on their devices. If you don't, please do so. If you need help, I can share whatever experience I have with you. Be glad to do that privately. Talk to your IT person. Take care of it. To me, that's a given. That's not what we're discussing here. There should be a filter on every device. There should be accountability. Human beings are fallible, and that's that topic. We're discussing actual usage, communication, and, as we will see, the desire to be communicated to, and the power of that ping that says, "You've got mail." Let's begin. The Chofetz Chaim, in the beginning of Hilchos Lashon Hara, his famous sefer, writes, "The prohibition of Lashon Hara applies both when one speaks verbally as well as when he communicates the information through writing. There's also no difference whether he communicates the information clearly or if he communicates it through a hint. In all cases, it's considered Lashon Hara." So, if anybody came into the world of internet and email usage thinking, I wonder if the Talmud speaks about this. I wonder if Torah has anything to say about virtual media. Our response would basically be like, give me a break. I mean, how pathetic do you think this system is? Yes, we already discussed Lashon Hara. And Lashon Hara doesn't matter if you write a letter or you wink in a way that disparages somebody else. All it takes is we're talking about who's capable of doing something at a committee, and you go, wink, like, right, like they're going to take care of it. If it's Lashon Hara, unless you have a system why it's constructive, whatever, and you did it correctly, but in terms of Lashon Hara, that's Lashon Hara. So the same would be if you figured out the right emotion, or whatever those little cutesies are called, and bounce ups and down. You're going to give me an education tonight, and it's going to bounce up and down, and everybody's going to understand that that person is foolish. It's fine. Okay. You got your message across? It's Lashon Hara. Welcome. The Chofetz Chaim in his footnotes points out that one of the sources for Lashon Hara is Makeh Basoser, a person who strikes his fellow in a hidden way. That's pretty broad. And the word prefacing that prohibition is the word Arur. You should be cursed. It's pretty heavy. Likewise, as I alluded to, if a person communicates through a hint on the verse, do not go as a peddler, lo selech rachel ba'amecha, Rashi says, like those who wink with their eyes to convey thoughts only known to those whom they wish to share their secrets with. I think we're on fair turf to say that this is not untrodden. There's a second prohibition, though, which I think comes up equally as much, maybe more, maybe less, and that's the topic of rechilus, which is simply sharing information that was supposed to have been discreetly guarded. My example of this child psychologist. No one did anything wrong, really. But it was supposed to be discreet. And it could be damaging. Well, why is it damaging? No one did anything wrong. I really don't care why it's damaging. But it is. The Chafetz Chaim, in his opening words in Laws of Rechilus, one who spreads news about his fellow is in violation of one shall not go tale-bearing. This applies even if it's totally true. Nothing bad about what he relates, if it causes pain or ill will. Now, I like the child psychologist example, although I don't believe it ever happened in our community, but I like the example because it's a violation, even if the parent posting it doesn't care. Because there's an important concept here. Parents don't own their children. And parents don't have the right to be indiscreet on their children's account. I'll finish the sentence without their permission, but they're underage, so their permission doesn't really help. We have a concept called ape telosa. If a person discloses information in front of three people without telling them to be discreet about it, there is a general assumption that they don't mind the information being spread. So if I tell you my birth date, even if I make a whole big deal with my kids that they don't know my birth date, or at least they let me think that they don't know my birth date, but I go ahead and I say it in front of three people and I don't make a big deal about it. The working assumption would be that if you didn't say, don't tell, you don't care. Three people is considered a degree of public. If a person says, I'm doing a merger with that company, says it over coffee and shul in front of three people, working assumption is that it's public information as far as he's concerned. And you would be allowed to relate it to your nearest and dearest. And they in turn are going to do the same. And before long, it will not be a secret at all. But then again, he never cautioned you that it needs to be a secret. That logic works, except for a few considerations. One of them being, he has to be the person who has the right to say, it doesn't bother me. But if he's doing a merger with somebody else, or he's making a shidduch, or breaking a shidduch with somebody else, it may not bother him, but he's not necessarily authorized to say it's not a problem, because it's affecting other people, and you don't have their consent. One of the areas that I believe we have to be careful of is sometimes an email gets a reply that's reply all, and it shouldn't be. If you have a comment to make to a person, you might choose to send it to him alone. This, I think, we've all had experience with. What gets more interesting is that sometimes people either replying or forwarding don't realize that there's a whole chat thread here. And all the way on the bottom, there's a comment that really was confidential. I know of a particular couple who were having a conversation about Hanukkah party and why one particular brother-in-law and sister-in-law are being very difficult. And eventually the chat continued to very pariv topics, and they started including the other siblings. But tacked in all the way on the bottom was a very indiscreet comment. Very painful comment. There are two smart techniques that a person might want to employ. One of them is start a new chat thread. Instead of hitting reply, it might be easier on everybody anyway. You go ahead, start a new chat thread, new title, summarize in two sentences with regard to the discussion of where we should have the banquet, and pose your suggestion instead of including everything that was possibly discreet from before. Another observation, you might want to compose your email without the two line filled out, and only fill it out once you're ready to send. Invariably, people hit send a little bit too early. If you hit send and you just forgot the attachments, it becomes a nice little joke between friends. But if you hit send too early, we sometimes have a problem. Another serious shaila, I believe, is posting pictures. As we'll see as we develop this, my focus is not to aser and say things are forbidden, but rather to say we have to be discreet. Sometimes you have a picture that was appropriate for camp or vacation. You have a girl who's got cream, puff cream, all over her face, and she's laughing, and it's great, and everybody of her friends thinks it's brilliant. But it's only brilliant because it's the middle of the summer, August 7th, without a care in the world. You post that. It's the equivalent of posting it on a job interview. Because nowadays, people go ahead and check Facebook pages to see what kind of person are you, and are you going to reflect badly on the company? And the same picture that might have been cute, innocuous, Maybe the boss will say, okay, I'm glad that when it's time to have a good time, they have a good time. But you might want to think, if it's appropriate to be in a public forum, remembering again that many of the places that we post things are not controlled environments. Friends have friends have friends have friends. And in many cases, depending on how you set up your system, many people may have access to it. The reverse is also true. Not only do they have access to my information, but the links and the encouragement and the mentality of the internet is that I have access to theirs. I was speaking to a psychologist locally here on the topic of internet, and when we discussed Facebook, Google Plus, I believe it's called, she cringed. She just started trembling. She said, are you serious? The kids are on? Get them off! And I asked her, and she told me. Because the same people that you would never associate with have now become accessible with all of the things that that brings. Not only that, but they're not just people you wouldn't associate. They have agendas. And they're reaching out and trying to create relationships with people that they never would otherwise. I'd like to move on to a very practical section, which is the concept of purposeful Lashon Hara. And again, our attitude in everything is not that any one of the tools is necessarily forbidden. They're tools in a toolbox. That goes for Facebook, it goes for email, it goes for everything. They are tools. If a person is using the tool wisely, okay, good. I think we all do. And I think we're glad. If the tool doesn't have rules, which is essentially my message, if it doesn't have rules, then we have a problem. What are the conditions of purposeful Lashon Hara? Person decides, I am supposed to say something about this. It behooves me to let people know. And boy, can I let people know. A few clicks, and the information is out. So let's go through them. Straightforward. Number one. Information has to definitely be true. Not from hearsay. So if I get an email that informs me that someone did something and my blood boils, how could he have done that? I ask you, honored audience, am I allowed to forward that email with my comments? I'm pretty angry. Well, I might believe that it's purposeful Lashon Hara, but I haven't met the first of the criteria. It's hearsay. Do I know it's true? But my blood is boiling. I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. I need to send out an email to the entire group and let them know. I'll even put in a disclaimer. If it's true that he did that, yeah, what do you do? I need to sleep tonight. I really need my sleep. Can I send the email, please, Rabbi? Oh, Abe Lincoln had a desk when he was president, and it had a hole. I don't know if he carved the hole there or the hole was there from the craftsman, but it had a hole. And when he was very, very angry at someone, which during wartime happened quite often, he would write a letter, and he would then choose not to mail it, and instead put it in that hole. That desk, by the way, was recently sold at auction with the letters for a tremendous sum. If you need to write the letter because your blood is boiling over, so just make sure there's no one in the two line, there's no one in the CC line, there's no one in the BCC line. And write what you need to write and send it to draft. Don't send it. That's the best I can do if you really need to write. Number two. It has to be that it's clearly wrong. It's not a subjective opinion. We have this by Shidduchim very often. I've encountered people who will describe neighbors as careless, insensitive, until I quiz them and say, why do you say that? And they describe how they're always late to meetings and parties and guest invitations. How late? At least 15 minutes. Okay. They're insensitive. I don't know. There's a magic word today. It's called cultural. It explains a lot. You need to really know that the person did you wrong. And it wasn't inadvertent before we get angry. And I think we all understand that one of the big disadvantages that we're at in email, everybody knows this, is that emotions are hard to read. That's why they invented these little emotion characters. I personally would wish that everybody should do a smiley after every line so there should be no misunderstanding. Believe me, I don't mean any harm to you. Just come on time. Number three. And this is deep. Chafetz Chaim writes that before you malign somebody and tell other people, because you're going to protect them from this evil person, you have to attempt reconciliation. That means you have to tell the person that you think they did wrong. Give them a chance to respond. And if they don't, in a satisfactory way, we can talk further. What's fascinating about that is that much of virtual communication is at a disadvantage for misunderstandings, because you don't have the body language and because you've never been able to give the person proper feedback. Whenever we have conversations, if you see the other person's facial expression a little bit like, huh, what are you talking about? So you either take a step back emotionally and rethink your position, or you explain yourself, etc. None of that is available. I click send. I don't get a reply. I have no idea if you're angry with me. My email went to spam and you never saw it. Or the email is sitting there and you're just going to take care of it when you do. What happens if it was offensive? I got no feedback. Chafetz Chaim essentially is saying, people sometimes make mistakes. Number one, give them a chance to explain themselves or give them a chance to back off and apologize. Rarely in email forums is that done. Number four, no exaggerations. Included in that, the Chafetz Chaim says in a footnote, is that if there are mitigating circumstances, they have to be taken into account. So that, for example, to tell somebody about somebody else, you want to take them in a shidduch or a business partner, they have a temper. How do you know? They once walked into the meeting and they were screaming and yelling, hollering like there's no tomorrow. Interesting. I do some research and I find out that that happened a year and a half ago when the person's parent was dying and they were financially strapped and the spouse was just fired and they lost their cool. I'm not justifying bad behavior. But mitigating circumstances have to be taken into account before we go ahead and jump to our conclusion. A good thing about email, I love it, everything's documented. A bad thing about email, everything's documented. What's so bad? I just want the truth. Yeah. But if a person wrote something 6 months ago under certain circumstances, and then you pull out that email out of context, you could destroy somebody, possibly without justification, because it was taken out of context. Number five, constructive intent. For a person to relate information, bad information about somebody, there has to be constructive intent. This, to many people, seems subtle. Over time, I believe it's obvious. You listen to the person's tone. Is the person trying to get you just as angry at the other person? Or is the person inviting you to calm them down? Listen to the tone. Boss is such a raging idiot. Yeah? Versus, my boss did something to me that really got on my nerves. I totally don't understand what he was doing. Now, a friend or a spouse listening to either one of these scenarios can tell fairly quickly what's the goal. I have found myself numerous times, as I'm sure you have, in situations where I need to tell somebody, if you're looking to emote, if you're inviting me to help you through this, I can help you through this. But if you want me to get angry at them, I'm not available. I'm not available to get angry at your mother-in-law. I'm not available to get angry at your spouse. I'm not available. Constructive intent. Number six, other solutions to accomplish the same thing. I do not want to commit an act of heresy. But if instead of using email, you could use the phone and accomplish the same thing by alerting the person, I don't think you should do that higher. Use the phone. It costs us more time in the short run. It saves a lot of heartache. And number 7, you're not allowed to harm a person more than you're justified in harming them. If this would be in a Beis Din in a Jewish court, how much would they get harmed? So for example, my blood is boiling over because I feel offended. Okay, I'm offended because I went to a dry cleaner and I spent $20 and the suit didn't get clean and they left me no recourse. So therefore I send out an email, no one should patronize them. How sweet. Yeah, so your entire din Torah with this company is $20. You might be right, you might be wrong. Maybe you gave them a stain that can't be taken out, they tried their best, whatever. Your entire claim is $20, and for that, you're prepared to trash their business with a bad reputation. That's not the toeles, that's not justified constructive intent. Again, I don't believe anybody would purposely do it, but I have a feeling that many people do not realize when they post something on a public page or on a public email server what the effect of their statement actually is. On the second side of the page, which I believe I'll just move through briefly with highlights, I'd like to take a introductory step into the philosophy and the ramifications of internet, not as much from a halachic perspective, as much from an attitude, from what we call Das Torah perspective. What would be accomplished by this, and I state this in our opening line, very bluntly, we are advocating for people to self-impose time and usage limits. According to the psychology information that's coming in different articles, Americans are spending between 3 and 7 hours a day browsing on the internet. Browsing includes checking emails, checking them. In other words, non-productive business time. We're not talking about that you downloaded a shiur or a lecture for that matter and listened to it for 40 minutes. That's not this type of time. That's no different. That's a tremendous benefit. That's using the internet smart. You have access to research. You went to a library. You didn't do the same thing. Talking about clicking on an advertisement which sends you to another advertisement which makes you very, very wise and worldly, but when we're all done, from a Torah perspective, we might say that we wasted our time. On the bottom of the page, I give you a little two-line consideration, which I think we need to be reminded, because many people in our generation do not appreciate this. The minute they hear regulation, even self-regulation, they get the feeling, are you speaking badly about my best friend, the internet? And we're not speaking badly. I don't speak badly about cars, but I still believe that you have to observe signs, stop lights, speeding regulations. Cars are great, but road rage isn't. Drunk driving, not acceptable. Texting while driving, not acceptable. Driving when you're overtired, not acceptable. That doesn't mean cars are bad. Same thing with food. Food, to the best of my knowledge, is a good thing. Nevertheless, improper use of food, overeating, cholesterol considerations, sugars, depends on the person. There are regulations to everything, if we're smart. And I would venture to say that all aspects of the internet and virtual realities are a toolbox. And you got to make sure to pull the right tool out of the box at the right time. In the interest of time, I'd like to go to the middle of the page, which is relationship and concentration disruptor. Cell phones, internet, email, texting have a tendency of causing a weakening in relationships and in our ability to concentrate. What's interesting, and is coming out now in psychological studies, Sherry Turkle of MIT is one of the most notable. In her book, Alone Together, I believe it's called, she describes how through texting we're very, very connected. We're connected with multiple people. But something very interesting is happening, that we're not really bonding with them. But we like it that way. In fact, many people, parent children, are finding that they would prefer to communicate by text than to communicate in person. And it's not just a convenience. It's actually like they prefer that. And one of the suggestions is that texting and email is an ego boost. That's why you'll find people just listless, checking. They feel a void. They want to trigger some sort of what? Some sort of, someone wants me. Someone's interested in me. Someone sent me a message. Even if that someone is Staples, or A.C. Moore, or ShopRite. I'm excited. Bing! You've got mail. I'm important. What's interesting is that relationships take emotional energy. For example, it's much easier to write, "I'm sorry," and click send, than to look someone in the face and say, "I'm sorry." It's a very different experience. And while we're more connected on that superficial communication level, we are risking a lack of deep relationships. I spoke on Shabbos about the product that's out there, a cell phone cage. We're walking into dinner. Everybody puts their phone in the cage, closes it, and sets it for 30, 45, or 60 minutes, and they eat supper together without distraction. I sure hope they put it on silent mode, otherwise it'll be lively. Because if you don't do that, someone calls me during dinner, I gotta take it, I gotta take the call. What happened to the family time? Now, we're very macho. We don't need family time. Except that we do. And if time is not intentionally carved out, then there is a very real weakness that develops. Rabbi Goldwasser, one of the early writings on the topic, he published in 2012 on actual addictions. He writes, statistically, 2/3 of teens prefer texting than to call. And he describes that it is possible that people are hiding their emotional readiness behind this virtual facade. One final comment before we conclude. The first section . A lot of what's available on the internet reflects the internet philosophy, which is very democratic, very popular vote. How many likes does your website have? Torah doesn't work with popular vote. What's interesting is that Torah works with a very mainstream concept. Very easy for people to grasp. Not sure why it's like eluding people. I ask the question, how do you identify an expert in the field? Any field. Law, medicine, any field, a hobby. How do you identify an expert? So according to the laws of internet, it's who's more popular. I don't say it's a perfect science, but if someone can't package his craft in a good way, I don't care if he knows his business. He couldn't package it. The correct way to identify an expert is to find out what their peers say about them. And we all know that. You don't choose a doctor primarily because of their bedside manner and how many people like them. Primarily, you choose a doctor because of their expertise. What do their peers say about them? I mean, they can't have an obnoxious manner, because that too would turn their peers off. Can't be haughty, but essentially you're looking for expertise. And the same really is in Torah. Torah is not a popular vote. It's not following the trends. Torah is the concept, which really it's the religious concept, the concept of looking to a mentor for truth, for authenticity, for something you can trust in. And as much as the internet can be used for research, Like any tool, we need to know its strengths and its weaknesses. We had an interesting incident just last week, played itself out in the Jewish world. There was a certain rabbi who apparently is a popular speaker, and he made a comment quite emphatically that the Holocaust wasn't 6 million Jews, really it was 1 million, and he figured out whatever reason he believed. It created quite an uproar. One of the respected rabbis in the Torah world, who's known as a historian, wrote a rebuttal and said, basically, this man is making a severe mistake and the ramifications are dire because we live in a generation of Holocaust deniers. And people have to know the truth. And what happened next was classic internet. I got people coming over to me, asking me on both sides of the fence, should we sign a petition to ban his lectures in the Jewish world? And others, just because he said one thing, let's have a petition not to ban his lectures in the Jewish world. And I am pleased to say that I was fortunate to have the good judgment to tell both sides of the coin to please keep their noses out of this business. The great people have spoken. It was rebuffed. It was quite clear this rabbi was making a severe mistake. And let it play itself out without our involvement. We don't need a petition here. And a few wise people got involved, and they made an appointment in which this rabbi, who for whatever reason was misinformed about this 1 million, 6 million Holocaust, I'm not sure where he grew up or got his information from, but they made an appointment with a survivor who patiently explained to him the scope of the Holocaust and the documentation, after which, face to face, this rabbi made an apology. He said, I was misinformed. Now, like I said, I'm very glad to keep my nose out of it. It's not my business to judge. The Jewish world got what it needed. It got clarity. It got clarification. It doesn't take petitions. And there are many areas where there's a tool there. It's a very powerful tool. And I'm not saying there's a clear-cut halachic position on each item across the board. But there are halachic and Jewish attitudes. And not every tool should always be used for every ill that we encounter. I'd like to call your attention on the bottom line that there has been a publication, fall 2015, called Klal Perspectives. It is available for free download if you do an internet Google search. And one of the articles there really makes a point which I believe is perfect in closing. We are the first generation of parents of the internet. We can't say our parents did too strict or too lenient, there's absolutely no springboard to work from. We are the equivalent of greenhorns in a new country. That means that we need to pay attention. And we need to form guidelines and standards and rules and realize we're dealing with something very powerful, very good, if it's harnessed correctly. I thank you for joining. Have a wonderful evening. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer. They could be emailed.